Hello there, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and its region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review Turkey Book Talk wherever you listen to it. Now, as I mentioned in the last episode, I'm very pleased to now be able to unveil for you a new membership system for Turkey Book Talk listeners. The podcast will, of course, remain free to listen for everyone. This special membership scheme simply adapts our previous Patreon donation page. If you sign up as a paying member, you'll get access to a range of extra content and benefits. These include full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. You'll also get transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English. That amounts to over 50 conversations so far, dating back to 2015, also in PDF form. Many of these transcripts were previously published at Hürriyet Daily News, but from now on, a Turkey Book Talk membership will be the only way to access them. I should also say that that archive includes many interviews not previously published on this podcast. Excitingly, as a member, you will also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey and Ottoman history books published by the great IB Taurus. They have a fantastic archive of titles, and over 200 books from their Turkey and Ottoman history series are available at cut price through a special discount code exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members. We've featured a number of IB Taurus authors on this podcast in the past, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work via a very handy discount. If you sign up as a member, you really will be helping us to develop the podcast. If we're able to get subscriptions up to reach a certain level, I'll be able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. So to become a Turkey Book Talk member, accessing these extra benefits and playing your part in supporting the podcast going forward, all you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. At present, I publish new episodes bi-weekly, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If ultimately I become able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum, which is not much more than the price of a couple of coffees. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then everything helps, and certainly you'll be more than welcome. But however much you offer, so long as you pledge that $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members are only charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. Basically, the aim of this new membership scheme is to turn Turkey Book Talk into a self-sustainable, reliable, and more wide-ranging source, providing a bigger platform for even more authors, academics, journalists, and researchers to get the word out about their work, which is now even more important than ever. In the medium to long term, I also want to develop our website and listener network and potentially branch out further into Turkish language content. But in order to take these steps, we need your support. So do consider taking advantage of this new membership system and helping to keep us going. You can find details at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. I'll also post links via the Twitter and Facebook pages. Also, please do share the podcast and news of its membership system with any friends or colleagues who may be interested. For podcasts like this, word of mouth is absolutely crucial, so it would be a great help if you do your bit. And if you don't actually like the podcast, you can always just share it with people who you don't like. You can find the details of this new Turkey Book Talk membership system via armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or through any of the other Turkey Book Talk pages. But enough of all that for now, let's get on with this latest episode. In it, we welcome Karabekir Akkoyunlu. He's an assistant professor at the Center for Southeast European Studies at the University of Graz. He's also the co-editor, along with Kerem Öktem, of Exit from Democracy, Illiberal Governance in Turkey and Beyond, which is published by Routledge. The book is a collection of 10 essays on just that subject, examining the anti-democratic turn in Turkey in recent years and comparing it to a range of other countries where similar things are happening. All in all, it's a very illuminating volume. And in this conversation, we talk about the current crackdown on academia in Turkey, the flavour of populism in the country, and opposition responsibility for the current state of affairs. But I started by asking Karabekir Akkoyunlu to talk about whether he's been surprised by the recent sharp decline in Turkey's political atmosphere.
I think most people have been surprised by how dramatic the decline and how quickly the decline has taken place. Even if we weren't necessarily seeing Turkey in very rosy pictures when everybody, you know, most everybody was praising it as a sort of model for democratic governance for the wider region and all that, it has definitely been a very dramatic case of authoritarian decline, one that is pretty much unprecedented in a country of its type, in a sense. So I would be lying if I said that no, this was all very much foreseen. But at the same time, there were definitely signs, and there were significant, you know, processes. If for those who've been following Turkey for you know, a long period of time, that made it clear that, you know, the whole veneer of democratizing Muslim country that had sort of worn off some time ago, and the trajectory had been downward and increasingly concerning. It's just that the last several years, that pace has accelerated so rapidly that a lot of people, even those who have been sounding the alarm on Turkey, in a sense have been caught unawares, or at least unprepared for the type of destruction, in a sense, that has come.
And looking, taking a kind of wider view, I mean, have you always been pessimistic, or is there a time maybe 10 years ago, you know, the classic era, much mocked now really, but at the time there was a very kind of powerful narrative of the Turkey model. Was that something that you ever subscribed to, or was that, were you always skeptical and always pessimistic that things could take the kind of course that they have done in the last few years?
I mean, if you're asking personally, I think earlier on, I definitely was more upbeat about Turkey, even though I also saw earlier on the rather superficial promotion of Turkey as a model and how it didn't necessarily reflect accurately what was going on the ground. But even then, you know, there were developments that gave one both reason to despair and to reason for hope, and you couldn't figure out which one would win over the other. And I think anybody who says that, you know, the outcome was preordained would be wrong, because there were a lot of contingent elements that turned out in a particular way. And I think we tried to outline some of them in our article with Kerem Müktem on the existential insecurity article, that actually came together to also bring out, in a sense, the worst of various possible scenarios. So I would say I would put myself in the middle and say that I was neither extremely, you know, hopeful and in a sense naive about what Turkey was going through. Turkey has had a very troubling past, has had very embedded institutions that are highly, you know, closed, you know, in a sense authoritarian, illiberal. There were embedded inequalities and historical questions that have been unaddressed, etc. So I was never under the illusion that these would be easy to deal with, or just merely addressing them would mean solving them. That it was clear that there would always be a backlash, potentially a violent backlash. But there was more hope as to what could come out of these new dynamics. I think that not only the situation in Turkey, but the global situation and the wider regional situation has deteriorated so much that two things have gone hand in hand. And Turkey has been one of the sort of, has turned into one of the exemplars of how things can go wrong.
One of the kind of key things that the book does is that it looks at the Turkish case in this kind of comparative context. You mentioned there the global atmosphere, the decline, not just in Turkey. But what the book does, it compares that, and we get various specialists comparing it with the situations in kind of a very wide range of countries, really. You know, you get Venezuela, Ecuador, Russia, Macedonia, Serbia. Seem like a very disparate group of countries, but when you compare and contrast, you know, you really do begin to be able to trace a few striking similarities and differences with Turkey. I mean, could you just kind of reflect a bit on what this approach can reveal to us about Turkey itself?
Exactly. The comparative approach in general is very, very useful. It's very fruitful in multiple ways. It allows, you know, the researcher to, as you said, detect similarities across nations, across regions, as well as unique sort of circumstances. You can compare reactions that particular governments or societies give to similar type of phenomena. And it does add an additional perspective that is missing from just a, you know, single case focus. In this sense, comparing Turkey with, as you said, disparate countries like Macedonia, Serbia, or Russia, or further afield, Latin America, first of all, reveals the transnational aspect of this illiberal, so to speak, authoritarian turn that we're witnessing in our time. There are a lot of common characteristics, whether it is the way this new illiberalism is different from old 20th century authoritarian governments. You know, we're not talking about military dictatorships or communist one-party rules, but oftentimes elected and ostensibly democratic governments gradually emasculating the political space, the free media, judiciary, etc. The use of the populist language, the us versus them dichotomy, and how this is used via different channels and manipulated via different channels. These are all various similarities that we come across a wide range of countries. But then again, there are also regional specificities that come across when we're comparing Turkey, for instance, with the countries of South or Central East Europe. When we look at Macedonia, Serbia, one element that comes out is A, how these countries actually talk to each other and learn from one another, especially the smaller ones from the larger ones. I mean, there's a sort of transfer of knowledge about how to deal with the opposition, how to reshape the media landscape, how to go about dealing with the judiciary, but also how the EU, for instance, has been instrumentalized in this process. As two of our papers point out, one, again, our paper with Kerem Öktem, and the other, the paper by Vedan Cicic and Cengiz Günay, the EU reforms have been used by all of these governments, which were once hailed as quintessential liberal reformers by the EU, as some sort of an opening space to change the institutional and political economic environment. So, you know, in a sense, that is an interesting comparison and similarity that comes out of this particular regional comparison. Then there is, for instance, the comparison of leadership styles when we look at Putin and Erdogan, or historical and geopolitical similarities between Russia and Turkey. But at the same time, there is also the big difference of existence of a much more historically well-established transition in the case of Russia, where right now the president is much more under in control. So when we also look at the cases of Russia and Turkey, we see similarities in leadership styles, but also how a case like Russia is a much more consolidated type of illiberal regime, and one in which that is not the case in Turkey under Erdogan, where there's a lot more embedded opposition and ambiguity with regards to the near future of the regime. So in a lot of ways, comparisons are very, very useful, not only to detect similarities, but also unique aspects of the countries that we're focusing on.
I think one of the things that these kind of comparisons help to do is, specifically thinking about Turkey, they kind of sidestep this binary question of Islamism and secularism. Of course, sometimes that context can be important to consider, but sometimes it can be a bit misleading as well. You know, focusing on it too much can kind of send you down the wrong path. And I think that's what these kind of comparisons do, really. If you look at it in another way, the Turkish government and what's been happening here for the last few years, it's really it's almost a kind of bargain basement authoritarianism, really. You know, it's not really that unique when you compare it. There's obviously a kind of Islamist secularist local characteristic there, but on the other hand, it really does share characteristics with other regimes in completely different contexts, completely different continents. So if you look at the cronyistic economic relationships that are being cultivated, as you mentioned, that the kind of right-wing populist rhetoric that's really, really easily traceable across many different, seemingly very different countries, it's kind of good to make these comparisons, because you realize that Turkey really is not kind of a unique case in the world in that sense.
Definitely. I mean, the Islamist versus secularist, or Islam versus secularism binary, has certain tangible aspects and certain uses. We cannot discard of it entirely, but it also is a very narrow and possibly misleading perspective to focus too much on, because as you said, it can actually throw us off as to where power relations actually lie. And especially in the last several years, since this major split between the two big Islamist sort of representatives of the Islamist movement, Gulen movement, and the AKP has taken place, we also see this traumatic fratricide within the Islamist movement, and as a result of which coalitions are shifting very quickly and in a very pragmatist manner. And there's definitely a return to a more classical, traditional, nationalist, state-worshipping discourse on the side of the Turkish government. And when we look at it from a more operational point of view, the discourse of populism, us, the people versus them, the elites, the fifth columnists, the traitors, that transcends not only national boundaries, but also the left-right boundary. It's not just the language of right-wing populism, but as the paper on the Latin American comparison with Turkey points out, a similar language is also used in left-wing populist examples in Latin America. Of course, the context is different. It's not an entirely similar type of populism, but at the basic level, that binary exists there as well. So yes, definitely, there's much more here than the simple Islamist versus secularist dichotomy in the Turkish case.
Now, the book is called Exit from Democracy, which is pretty unambiguous. And you co-author a piece in the book with Kerem Öktem, where you discuss, it's a very good piece. You make this argument based on this idea that increasingly high stakes, zero-sum calculations are now being made by the government. And this really is a driver of authoritarianism. And it really does kind of portend a rather depressing road forward, actually, because you kind of make the case that President Erdogan is now kind of no longer in a position to share or relinquish power in some hypothetical scenario where he may lose it and he has to dominate in order to survive. You write that in an environment where political actors fear for their survival, the nature of politics shifts from deliberative to zero sum. Existential insecurity instills an all or nothing logic to decision making, rendering meaningful concessions and power sharing costly, risky, and even suicidal. So you basically together argue that this means that Turkey has crossed the Rubicon, really, and has finally left the realm of democratic politics because of these high stakes calculations.
One of the key necessities or requirements of democracy is that you have free and fair elections. And then in those elections, an incumbent, when they lose, they relinquish power, they lose office, and they go into opposition. Now, that is the basic functioning principle of democracy. We observed in the elections, the twin elections of 2015 in Turkey, that threshold was crossed, not in a very overt institutional way, But when we looked at the general picture in an unmistakable way, in the sense that in the first big election where the governing party lost its majority, parliamentary majority, the president and the AKP chose a course whereby they prevented, in a sense, the emergence of a new sort of political coalition or political dynamic. They were very openly against this idea and started to work on putting together conditions for a new election under very different social political dynamics. This to us was the big red alert that the basic condition and requirement of democracy had been breached. So we discussed this with participants to a conference in late 2015, out of which came this special issue and the edited volume, actually, whether this was, you know, a clear signal of crossing that boundary of democracy, whether Turkey had actually exited democracy already at that point. And, you know, there was discussion for sure. But at that point, I wouldn't say that there was a clear consensus on the academic spectrum as to where to place Turkey on sort of a regime typology. So everybody was admitting that Turkey had gone far away from the type of democracy that it was aspiring to, or, you know, Democrats were aspiring for it to go. But could we actually call it no longer a democracy? Was it an authoritarian state? What was it? But then by the time we published the special issue and we went for this title, Exit for Democracy, which our publishers actually came up and said, that's a provocative title, you know, you might be going ahead of yourselves. By the time the special issue was out, which was after the failed coup attempt and the declaration of the state of emergency with the purges that followed, there was very little doubt that Turkey had already gone and was now descending at a very fast speed into a new and quite a depressing institutional environment. And in a sense, we were vindicated only recently, if you will, with the publication of the latest Freedom House report. People take these quite seriously, perhaps more so than they actually deserve to be taken seriously, but they sort of set the tone on major concepts. And for the first time in this report on freedom around the world, Turkey was categorized not as a partly free state, but as a non-free, not free state. And it was designated as the country which had demonstrated the most dramatic decline in freedoms across the world, faster than quite a few countries that had actually, you know, gone also retrenched very, very fast. So in a sense, the period that we are looking for is a period where there was some debate about where we could categorize, where we could place Turkey. And very quickly, we've stopped talking about this. And basically, there's not much ambiguity about where Turkey lies right now. And it's definitely not in democracy in the sense that we understand it.
This also kind of strikes a chord on an intuitive level as well. I mean, when you kind of think about the rhetoric that's coming out of the government, you know, every single day it's just relentless and it's so black and white, and there's really seems to be no way back from that now. You know, once you start pushing that narrative, it really is, you know, there really is this very strong belief in the government that they're involved in this kind of sacred cause, or dava in the Turkish. It's filled with all this evocative national rhetoric, and it's very difficult to see, you know, how you can walk that back. You know, people often optimistically kind of hope that maybe Turkey can quote normalize, you know, or Turkish politics can normalize and return to a kind of more or less ordinary competition based democratic system. But it's hard to imagine any of that happening when, as you mentioned, the stakes have been raised so high, and when the rhetoric has really gone so far down this path. It's very difficult, almost impossible really, to see how they can reverse course now.
It's difficult or impossible precisely because the actors steering Turkish politics today see this type of normalization as difficult or impossible, because they have reached a mindset where they see any type of step back as, you know, beginning of the end, falling into the abyss. That doesn't necessarily mean that some sort of normalization is really objectively impossible, because, you know, as things can get worse due to new decisions being taken, it's feasible to think that there could be different trajectories in the long run as well. But as the actors push themselves in corners, as wounded animals becoming more aggressive and less willing to negotiate and talk, the willingness to compromise also reduces. And that, of course, then leads only one or two scenarios. One is the sort of consolidation of this authoritarian regime, where opposition is fully suppressed and eradicated, which would be very, very difficult in the Turkish case. There is a very significant source of opposition, both political and social, to the current government. Or a collapse of this government and a new and very unpredictable period, starting with perhaps, you know, on the ground zero. But what I wanted to say is that until we got to this point, there were several exits that could have been taken that would have probably prevented this type of outcome from happening. We also tend to think of where we are as the only possibility of the outcomes. It wasn't necessarily the case. You know, there were possibilities, let's say, during the Gezi protests, for various different sides to actually come to a different conclusion and choose a different path. That wasn't taken precisely because the political actors thought compromise was impossible and it would lead them to collapse. Perhaps it would, but perhaps it wouldn't. So we also don't know that again today. But the more they think they're under siege, the less likely they will seek any type of compromise, and we will keep going in this vicious circle until something gives.
And what do you make actually about the kind of the opposition's responsibility really for this state of affairs? Because there's an argument, you know, throughout the 2000s and 2010s, the opposition, or the main opposition party, the CHP particularly, but more generally as well, it was really very feckless, and it really failed to put up the kind of mature 21st century opposition that's necessary for any democratic system. I mean, how much do you think the problems of today are a result of a kind of broader systemic failure, including those opposition parties, and how much can be put more squarely at the door of the government and its allies?
I think the opposition has nearly as much blame to share as the government, perhaps even more on Turkey's current predicament. And by opposition, I actually really mean the Republican People's Party, because even though it is an opposition party, the Nationalist Action Party, MHP, is fulfilling its political goals, its agenda in a curious sort of way. And the HDP, the pro-Kurdish leftist People's Democracy Party, has put up a very vibrant opposition, which did actually provide a sort of existential challenge to the government. And hence, we saw the massively violent and intense reaction from the state and the government against it. So when we look at that, of course, that kind of reaction, perhaps it's understandable that the CHP doesn't want to be in the same position. It is the founding party of the Turkish state. It doesn't want to be squarely put under a label of terrorists and lumped together with what many of its own electorate also sees as separatists, and terrorist sponsors and supporters, etc. So it chooses to remain within the sort of boundaries that now the government draws for it, and doesn't challenge it on a very difficult core issues. That is an inconsistency that comes out of the CHP's own paranoid, schizophrenic nature. It is, in a sense, a social democratic party, but at the same time, it has a significant base that is very nationalist and very statist, which, when it comes to, for instance, things like the operation in northern Syria or Iraq, that base shares similar sentiments with the nationalists on the right. And they can come together against, the Kurds, for instance, or when there's an issue of what happened to the Ottoman Armenians in 1915, these kind of existential issues. And the government, being aware of it, takes perfect advantage of this situation, draws the boundaries and pushes significant events and policies on the basis of these existential debates, which the opposition cannot, in the end, oppose to. What the opposition should do is to invent a language, invent a discourse that actually doesn't allow itself to be painted as the way that the government wants it to. But for this, it lacks both the creativity, the media channels and exposure, but also internal cohesion. So there is a systemic problem when it comes to the internal structure of the CHP as well, that makes it very difficult to act as an effective opposition party.
And just kind of projecting forward, really, I mean, what do you imagine? I mean, Erdogan, he's dominating everything at the moment, but of course he's not going to be around forever. He's not getting younger. He's not old, but he's getting older all the time. And there's this kind of idea that he puts out. It's a classic authoritarian move, really, that it's him standing between Turkey and chaos. And, this is a real line that is very effective, actually, in rallying people behind him. But in a way, in a curious way, he's right, actually, because the state has been so completely deinstitutionalized, it seems, and so personalized around him, that it's very easy to imagine that once he's gone from the scene, some kind of chaos is just going to inevitably emerge, because he really is the thing that's holding things together because of this level of mismanagement. I mean, is that something that you imagine going forward?
Yes, I think it's telling that the way we're talking about the future of the Turkish state now resembles the debates that are taking place in Iran, for instance, as to what will happen once the supreme leader is dead, or the talk in Egypt back when Mubarak was still around and aging, what's going to happen when he leaves the scene. So it already gives us a sense that things have changed. To what extent they have actually changed institutionally, and when and Erdogan is out of the picture somehow, what will have remained of these institutions? It's difficult to say precisely. We may find them more resilient in the long term than they seem to be, or we may not. It's difficult to put a finger on it and say precisely that this is the state of the institutions, because A, there is a lot of quick change that's happening, very profound change that is happening, that makes it difficult to gauge in a healthy way the state capacity of Turkey, and B, because also of this continuous rhetoric that is coming out of Erdogan and the government, that if he's taken out of the fray, Turkey is faced with chaos. And I should point out that it's not just to the domestic audience that Erdogan is making this a case, but also implicitly to the international audience, especially to the West, where there's an increasing dislike of Erdogan as a leader, but also an understanding that things will get much messier in Turkey and in the wider region if he leaves the fray. It is very true that he has ultimately brought Turkey to a point where Turkey is facing the classic authoritarian dilemma. He's holding the country so firmly in his fist, or he's trying to hold it so firmly in his fist, that it's not a sustainable path. It's a repressive path that might and that will have the conditions to explode at one point. But if he releases the fist, things can also spread out in an uncontrolled fashion as well. And it's difficult to really say what will happen. And that is, of course, you know, what we will see. And in the short or medium term, we don't even know whether we can actually bank on Erdogan being in power for as long as he wants to. It really is difficult to predict. I mean, there is institutional possibility, political possibility for him to be in power for another 10 years at least. And if he does manage that, what kind of society and state Turkey will be by that time is anybody's guess. But it will be very different from even what we have today. But if Erdogan does come out of the picture within the next few years, we will be facing a very different reality.
Now, you've worked abroad in universities for the last few years, and I also want to address this kind of question of the changes in the in academia in Turkey in recent times, because things are really not looking very good, it's fair to say. Turkish universities are plummeting down the international rankings, freedom of research and expression is becoming ever more curbed, hundreds, thousands of academics have been removed from their positions, particularly since the coup attempt in 2016. The Higher Education Institute, YÖK, this kind of notorious institute, and once upon a time, amazingly enough to think, you know, 10 years ago, the AKP was talking about abolishing this institution because it was seen as being so notorious and being such a pillar of an authoritarian system, but it's now only more overweening than ever, and the AKP is very happy to use it. So there's been this kind of very broad deterioration in the democratic environment, but that's also had its ramifications in academia. I just wondered if you could just reflect on this. I know that you've not been in Turkish academia for a few years, but just kind of reflect a bit on this aspect and how you see it up to now and going forward.
The academic landscape in Turkey hasn't been this depressing, I would say, even at the height of the worst days of the 1980 coup. And you're right to say that the institutional background for what's happening now was laid down in Turkey's illiberal past before the AKP. So there's definitely a continuity there, but also a new dimension, a new sort of intensity as well. Conditions for academics are not very uplifting in most parts of the world. You know, academics are under very precarious work conditions in neoliberal academia, with a stress, you know, major stress and pressure to raise funds and compete with each other to publish or perish kind of mentality. But, you know, the situation in Turkey is way beyond that. And for the last couple of years has been deteriorating very rapidly as politics has entered academia and academics have entered the political sphere with their interventions and their statements and so on and so forth. You know, besides the reaction of the government to rooting out what it sees as non-yerli ve milli, non-national and authentic academics who are often, you know, the secular, left-wing, socialist, Kurdish, or generally just critical thinking academics, one might say, there is also a new attempt by the government to hegemonize what it calls the cultural field. Erdogan has made repeated references to this. He has said that we have achieved political success, economic success, but we have failed in the cultural field. And now I think he sees that his legacy is quite tentative and is superficial. And he is worried about what will be there in the long run, what will remain. So as a result of this, we see these attempts now to more systematically reshape academia by A, purging people that they don't want, B, changing institutional sort of regulations to open up space for more sympathetic academics that are more sympathetic to the government to actually take positions in academia, by actually lowering a lot of standards for academic excellence, academic performance, which in the long run is will have disastrous consequences, but also opening up new universities like the Ibn Khaldun University that is chaired by the son of President Erdogan, which are used as tools of manufacturing a sort of new intellectual consent or adding some intellectual weight to the government's political hegemony. But these attempts are very hollow. They don't have the intellectual weight that such a cultural project needs. One might compare it, for instance, to the kind of purges and restoration that took place in Iran after the Islamic Revolution there, the Cultural Revolution, as it was called. But there was a very significant contingent of intellectuals, both from the left and from the Islamist backgrounds, that supported and contributed to this kind of transformation. The government at the moment is very much lacking that kind of support. So I doubt that the process will yield desired results, and the casualty will be Turkish academia and Turkish intellectual field, public field, public space for a very long time to come.
It's funny, you mentioned that. It's a very good point to make, I think, as well, because you do touch on this issue there of the government kind of turning its focus towards the cultural area. There's been a very obvious shift towards this attempt at social engineering, you could say, really, in the last 5 or so years, using the school system, again, using academia, but also talking more broadly about, you know, this kind of more yerli vermili, national and native emphasis. And it's a really classic thing that any government wants to do, or an authoritarian government wants to do. It's to shape society from the center. And in a way, I don't know, it's people tend to panic about it, and there's a very good reason to do that because it can cause enormous damage as well. But I wonder also if there's not a sense that, you know, it's very difficult to actually do any of that. You know, you can try as much as you want, but society in a way has its own dynamics, and it's very difficult to mold it. However many tools you have, society is always going to be a very, very complex thing that can't always be shaped simply by a few changes to the school system. It's something, I don't know if it's an optimistic point to make, but it's maybe something to kind of think about when people assume that these changes that the government tries to make and does make in many senses on paper and in institutions, that whether those will end up having the kind of results that the government actually wants in the long run. It's still not clear to me that that's the case. I don't know if you have any reflections about that, like this kind of relation between the state and society, and how much influence even the most overweening government can actually have when it comes to shaping or reshaping society as it wants.
I will say yes and no. The government is trying to carry out a refoundational project. At least Erdogan is trying to do so. It's trying to establish in both institutional, political terms, but also on the discursive level, the new Turkey that he has in mind and he's constantly talking about. On the institutional level, that involves all these changes to the political system, from parliamentarism to presidentialism. But also there's this idea of a new Turkey, and a lot of its symbols and heroes are being put forward differently from what the old Turkey of, Kemalist Turkey would be about. You know, we have more emphasis on Ottoman heroes and an imagined sort of a very superficial Ottoman past, victorious nationalist Turkish Muslim, etc. I agree with you that this kind of a top-down foundational project, which is in many ways using the tools of the early 20th century, not very different from how the Kemalist Republic was established 100 years ago, will have difficulty to achieve its goals, even more so than its predecessors in the current 21st century scenario. I mean, you may limit internet and monopolize media as much as you want, but there's only there's a certain limit to how much you can control dynamic social, political, and economic dynamics in the country to the extent of reshaping society in the image that you want. I mean, even the early 20th century or late 19th century, nation builders only succeeded so much in doing this. And there was a lot of time, a lot of opposition, embedded resistance that came up one way or another. And things never really went the exact way that these foundational leaders wanted to go, necessarily. I mean, that is the fluidity of history, and history is even more fluid at this point, and much more transnational. But even though the government's projects or the government's objectives may not be reached, they will have an impact on society, on the generations to come, by these projects and by these top-down policies that the government is pursuing. It may not be what the government wants to see in the end, but there will be a net impact. All of these changes to the education system, all this sort of nationalist propaganda that is being pumped from every channel on social media and mainstream media, and generations that are growing up in this type of atmosphere, it definitely will affect the way Turkey society and political and social sort of ideas and terrain will be shaped in the future. So in that sense, I think there is a great cause for concern. I'm not concerned that Erdogan will achieve what he wants to achieve. I'm concerned that he will not achieve, and it will be even more of a shamble than is being sort of prescribed by the government for the Turkish state and society. And that is the crazy dilemma of what we're dealing with, you know, a top-down sort of social engineering project in the 21st century, at a time when Turkey needs to invest in its education system, invest in its social, intellectual infrastructure in order to remain a viable state and society and compete in a very cutthroat global environment.
And just to conclude, really, I mean, I wonder if it's very difficult. It's been a bit of a pessimistic conversation, obviously. But do you have any, in any realm, like, is there any positive green shoots that you see going forward, or do you think that it's completely right to be pessimistic about the trajectory in Turkey at the moment?
I think being completely pessimistic is self-defeating. So just even for practical purposes, in order to find a ray of hope and sunshine, we need to look for it. And for that, we need to keep on believing, in a sense, that there are possibilities of better developments in the future. So that is from a very sort of, you know, idealistic point of view. But at the same time, I still believe that despite all the pressure, all the polarization, all the institutional changes, political dominance and media hegemony that the government has had, the purges and etc. What we have seen in, for instance, the latest referendum for presidentialism is that it has failed to convince and win on its side at least 50% of Turkey's population. So if there was an outcome, a believable outcome in that referendum, whereby, let's say, 80% of the people supported the proposed changes, I would say, well, I think we need to bow our heads and accept the new reality as it is. And that is, for instance, one of the differences between Turkey and Russia, as is also put out in that comparative paper in our special issue, where opposition is more narrow and more limited than Turkey. So there is a history in Turkey that I think is repeating, whereby different and disparate groups of people with very different backgrounds, political backgrounds, do resist and do oppose governments that are too suppressive and too hegemonizing. So if that can be nurtured one way or another towards some sort of a common democratic ground, if out of that can come a very basic new social contract eventually, I would see that as the main path for hope in Turkey. And that exists. But there are also clear obstacles and clear difficulties in operationalizing that potential.
That was Karabekir Akkoyunlu. Many thanks to him. Check out armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com for a link to my review in Hurriyet Daily News of the volume we were talking about. And don't forget to consider joining our new Turkey Book Talk membership system. For a minimum $3 per episode, members get access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, and also exclusive access to a special 30% discount on well over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. Perhaps even more wholesomely, you'll be helping Turkey Book Talk to keep the show on the road, developing further and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. Don't forget to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever platform you listen on. You can also follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes. I also very much enjoy receiving emails from listeners, so please do send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, once again, thank you very much for listening.